Just a little bit about our groups and some quick introductory remarks, and we'll get to our workshop, The Crisis in U.S. Media and the Growing Movement for Media Democracy. Toward Freedom is a 53-year-old Vermont-based media education nonprofit organization. William B. Lloyd started it back in the 60s, and he actually began a focus on the developing world, writing all about what was happening in Africa and the liberation movements there. And the magazine was actually a physical paper publication for many years. And just recently, within the last year or so, it converted to an online publication, towardfreedom.com. And we have a wonderful editor who unfortunately couldn't be here today, Ben Dongle, who helped arrange many of our guests who will be speaking to us today. And I hope you'll check it out, towardfreedom.com. And our particular radio program has been on the air since 1991, Between the Lines. We have it broadcast in about 40 stations around the country. And we began our program with coverage of the Persian Gulf War in 1991 and continued right through this latest Iraq War, and on we go. Our web address is btlonline.org. And together, our two groups organized a media crisis workshop in the World Social Forum in Caracas, Venezuela. And we had many speakers from around the Caribbean and Latin America, Venezuela, Cuba, Haiti, and so on. We actually have an audio tape of that program. And I believe, Michael, you have a videotape of that workshop. So just by way of some introductory comments about the media, I think everybody here is aware of the failure of U.S. corporate media. And we are all pretty familiar with its failures regarding the most recent lead-up to the Iraq War. We're familiar with its failings in regard to the shredding of the U.S. Constitution, torture, wiretapping, environment, economic inequality, health care, labor, any issue you could think of, the media has failed the American people. And right-wing corporate media, on the other hand, is extremely well-funded, whether it's the explicit right-wing radio talk shows of Rush Limbaugh and Mike Savage and those guys, or it's just the corporate media, CNN based here in Atlanta, or all the rest of the big corporate networks. We're aware, of course, the Christian right has a growing number of radio stations that they control. And Chris Hedges, of course, gives a great warning to us all about the power of the Christian right, and they use media very expertly. Free Press is a group that's been working for media democracy with their media and democracy conferences, their work to campaign against deregulation with the FCC and the like. And, you know, that work is so important. But the work that we're going to focus on, I think, today is really keeping our independent media projects, our non-commercial stations, our independent publications, the online publications, all that, keeping it alive and vibrant and sustainable. Because I think we've all experienced, and some of our speakers today will tell you their own experience, of the difficulty it is to keep these projects going with little or no funding, on all volunteer power, people stretched to the limit. We have a passion for it, but we have to sustain these things, and we have to make them bigger and better, reach a wider and more diverse audience. And, you know, of course, to really quantify this, I don't know if you guys have seen this latest study by the Center for American Progress and Free Press, the structural imbalance of political talk radio, upwards of 91%, and surveys did across the United States showed that right-wing hate talk radio, you know, predominates. We didn't need this study to know that, but it's nice to have it all quantified here for us. And, it sends the alarm and, you know, I guess to spur us on to do more than we're doing. Liberal progressive foundations have traditionally not funded in any meaningful way the independent media, the independent press. You know, there are some exceptions to that. Democracy Now! Is very well funded, but there are others of us out there struggling that are not well funded at all. And progressive organizations, peace groups, labor organizations, civil rights groups, civil liberties groups, it seems that critical to all of our struggles, all of our campaigns, all of our work is the fight that we have to keep on pushing against in terms of the misinformation, the framing of the issues of the day from the corporate press, the corporate media, which makes our work difficult, if not impossible. And we really have to make sure, you know, I think this every day, and you're probably here in this workshop because of it, that we need to do more to change the framing of the big issues in the country. Doing more to develop and keep sustainable our independent media projects seem fundamental to that whole idea. You know, we've all toyed about the idea of, you know, funding big projects like a labor-funded daily newspaper or a cable channel, something like that. It's hard to say if that's an end that's worth the effort. But it's certainly, I think, safe to say that our independent media projects require a lot less money and are a lot more viable in terms of the little money it would take to push these things to a wider audience. So I certainly don't stand here with any magic bullets or ideas that would, could be put into action tomorrow. But I know some of our speakers today will have some ideas and have some life experience working in the independent media, creating new projects, funding their projects, and certainly some ideas that have not been put into action yet. And we're very proud of the people that are going to be speaking today. Our first speaker is going to be Nate Jones. He's an anarchist activist living here now in Atlanta who works inside a corporate media network, and he's got some war stories for us. We also have Jen Angel. She's the co-founder and former publisher of Clamor Magazine, and I'm sure she'll explain why Clamor Magazine no longer is published. Elizabeth De Novella, she is here with us, and she is going to talk about her experience in independent media. She's the culture editor at the Progressive Magazine. And finally, we have Michael Albert, the co-founder of Z Magazine, and well-known to many of you, the author of Paracom, Participatory Economics. So I just want to make mention of a couple of people that were on our panelist list that could not attend today. We had Jerry Colby, who was the president of the National Writers Union, and Charlotte Dennett, an author and attorney, as well as Miguel Molina, who had transportation problems, Miguel Molina from KPFA. He couldn't get here to Atlanta, and Jerry Colby and Charlotte had a personal emergency they had to attend where they send their apologies. Right now I'd like to introduce Nate Jones. He's helped form the now-defunct Arkansas Anti-War Coalition in 2001 in response to U.S. attacks on Afghanistan, helped organize actions against the latest Iraq War with the Arkansas Anti-War Coalition, and he's participated in various single-issue causes, including immigrant solidarity, Palestinian solidarity, anti-Iraq war activity, fighting against anti-poverty and homelessness ordinances here in Atlanta since moving to the city in 2004. He's worked for ABC affiliate KIIT, television station in Jonesboro, Arkansas, from 2001 to 2004. He's currently working at the Turner Broadcasting Corporation, and he's helped form an Atlanta anarchist group back in 2006. He's engaged in various forms of media activism, including podcasting, YouTube videos, websites, and the like. Nate is now working to form an independent alternative media federation. So, Nate, you want to come up and say a few words?
How y'all doing today? A little intimidating. It looks like we're all ready to play a little duck, duck, goose, right? We're all in a little circle here. I'll start with you, Doc. No, for real, though. My name is Nate Jones, as you guys have heard about six times now. And I do currently work for Turner Broadcasting. I work for network operations inside Cartoon Network. I don't do any actual, reporting or anything of that nature. I do grunt work to, keep the propaganda flowing, recording stuff, and, making sure it stays on the air, et cetera. I started out in corporate media in 2001, right after the 9/11 attacks, in an ABC affiliate in Jonesboro, Arkansas, called KIIT-TV. And the peculiar thing about this, though, was about 11 months earlier, I decided I was an anarchist, So there was a lot of dichotomy there, So and this is not a good time to be going up in media outlets, being an anarchist in Arkansas and saying, we're telling a bunch of lies. Literally, I would tell these people blatantly to reporters, to the news editors, to the all the way up to the general manager on occasion that, we were engaged in, blatant subterfuge. I would present them with evidence on occasion when they would ask, because they didn't ask a whole lot, obviously. They weren't just, hey, tell us all about what we're doing wrong here. They were more, no, wave the flag, let's go. But what I found would happen, even within these corporate structures, is that when you talk to, reporters, or you talk to people, the news desk or whatever, they'll give you some kind of perfunctory response. Oh, wish we could have gotten that in there. Concision won't allow it. But when you talk to the actual people who are engaged in, the production, the directors, the audio operators, the photographers, they were very, very keenly interested in it. and so keenly interested in fact that by the time I started in November 2001, by the time I left in 2004, we couldn't have anything from ABC News, any feed come down, where I didn't where we couldn't be on the air live during the newscast, where somebody wasn't like, "That's a bunch of lies, huh? Isn't that just a bunch of lies, Nate?" And I'm like, "Yes, it's a bunch of lies. That's what I've been telling you for years." And so I've used that experience to formulate, you know, a kind of tentative theory called occupational insurrection. It works very well within mainstream media outlets in that people there kind of get the idea that they're being lied to even more avidly than, like, we would. Or they're even, you know, not obviously, again, not the reporters, but the people who are doing the work that, you know, maintains the reporters. So what I've tried to do is, you know, engage in consciousness raising. You know, by making comparisons between their everyday activities within bureaucracy and hierarchy and extrapolating that to, you know, government activity and how the media works. And from there we go, you know, we get to a point where I'm saying, where I talk about why, you know, why would we leave something out, or why would this be included in, or why, you know, why, you know, or I would show them blatant examples of a power. For instance, CNN International, this is a good story. CNN International, they had a right-wing Latin American expert on. My friend Carlos Martinez was running the audio board, you know, mic and people and everything. Well, this Latin American expert, obviously, and as we all know from the mainstream media, had, you know, very little, as in nothing, good to say about Hugo Chavez and the Bolivarian democracy in Venezuela. Well, as it turned out, Hugo Chavez was watching the program, and he called in to the control room. And he said, "Hey, you know, I'm not very pleased with all this." So so the producer, and apparently this is the look that Carlos gave me. The producer looked like that, you know. I mean, that's the look that he said. So they put him on the air. They ask him two questions. Then they get him right back off the air. Well, the other guy keeps going on. About 5 minutes later, well, guess who calls right back? It's Hugo Chavez again. He's like, "You can't just let him keep going on and everything." But they wouldn't let him on again. They refused to allow him, you know, on. They would not let a head of state refute, you know. I mean, and this is actual examples. A head of state couldn't refute somebody that, you know, blatant lies that somebody was saying about him. It's not surprising, but I think it is surprising even to us that it gets to that level where, like, you know, the president of Venezuela can't call a producer on the air and say, "Hey, this is what's going on." I couldn't. Part of my job at KIT was also to build graphics, you know, the cute little pictures that tell all the story while the guy, you know, tells the lies, you know, this one. So my job was to put, like, words underneath them to kind of summarize them. Well, one of them was about the U.S. embargo of Cuba and how the U.N.'s just not too fond of it, right? You know, they don't really like it. So I put, this was about the time we were about to blow, you know, Iraq, you know, to hell and back, over defying the U.N. So I put as my tagline, "U.S. defies U.N." That was it. I was like, that's it. That's the tagline, right? That's what's happening. The U.N. says you should stop. The U.S. says we're not going to. I have to talk to the producer, the news director, and the station director, and they finally all say, "You're just going to have to change that." I'm like, "But that's the story." They're like, "Change it to something U.S. differs from U.N." I'm like, no, this isn't differ. You know, this is defying. They were told to do it. You know, these shouldn't come as surprising examples, but I think it does. It's weird how it permeates to that level. And, I mean, if you're interested in other war stories or what have you, I can talk about that. But the beautiful thing is, because of the consciousness raising with the average Joes and the average grunts, guess what we have access to all of a sudden? Just a plethora of people who have a lot of media experience, a lot of media equipment sitting around their home because they tend to be very, very interested in it, not only in their job but as, like, a, you know, side job. Because most media people, grunts, you know, production, but they don't make a lot of money. So they, like, you know, videotape birthday parties and bar mitzvahs and, I don't know, skydiving or whatever over the weekend. You know, so they have this equipment and they want to use it. And they're ready to use it. And, you know, they want to use it for a good cause to at least offset all the sins that they're at least, you know, perceived sins or whatever they're, you know, at least conjoined with in some, you know, loose way. So that's essentially what I've been doing. I've actually talked to a lot of people. A lot of people in Atlanta anarchists actually come from the media. My aforementioned friend Carlos Martinez still works at Turner. Corey Dayett, also an Atlanta anarchist. These are people I all met. Still work at Turner. And we have kind of banded together to start working on a alternative live internet radio broadcast. We've thanks to their expertise and thanks to their, you know, tireless dedication, we've been able to film and get on YouTube various events of, like, where the police came down hard on protesters as opposed to those, you know, lovely Minutemen, as we're all very, we love those guys, right? But we're able to do that because they have that expertise and because they're ready. And I think that while we should obviously be very, very, you know, anti the corporate media, the output, we should be very careful not to lump everybody together into that category. The guy who's carrying the Fox camera around, guess what? He hates Fox News too. He probably hates it more than you. He's out there, it's hot. The guy on the phone doesn't care, and he's got the 37-pound camera on his shoulder. So I just want to say, to wrap up, because I'm not going to talk very much longer because I feel like I'm really outclassed on this panel. But I do think that there is a well of opportunity, and I do think that there are a lot of experiences that I can impart upon you if anybody's interested, care to ask about during the participatory aspect of this panel. And thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Nate. We're all one class here in that class. Our next speaker is Jen Angel, and again, I have to thank Jen and Nate and Liz also, because they jumped on board this panel at the very last minute due to some of the other problems we had getting our original panelists here, so thank them all for kind of putting this together at the last second. Jen Angel is the co-founder and former publisher of the now-defunct Clamor magazine. Jen is a founding board member of the Allied Media Project, and which she organized recently, the 9th Annual Allied Media Conference. She currently works as a producer for the KPFA program Against the Grain and books tours for radical authors and filmmakers. Right now, Jen is booking a tour for Army of None, Strategies to Counter Military Recruitment, and End War and Build a Better World by Amy Allison and David Solnit. Let's have a little applause for Jen. Thank you, Jen.
So Nate said he was outclassed, but he's the only one who has jokes, so, So I'm going to talk for just a minute about my history of working with Clamor and other outlets, and then talk about some of the good things that are going on in independent media right now, and then some of the challenges. So I thought I'd start with some of the good things, because we all know that there's a ton of challenges. So Clamor started in 1999. We published up until December 2006. Me and one other person founded it, and the kind of purpose of the magazine was to provide a new outlet for a participatory kind of media, that there's all these people out there with stories to tell who aren't experts, who don't have journalism degrees, so where can they publish their stories? So we wanted to have, we felt that that was something that was really missing, and that was why we were publishing the magazine. And we published 38 issues. At our peak, we printed 10,000 copies, which is very small in the media world, and we were distributed around the U.S. So that's a little bit about Clamor. When I talk about some of the challenges, I'll talk specifically about why Clamor closed, and because it's kind of based on the climate for magazines and things right now. The first and most important thing I want to say is that I think that independent media is essential for democracy, and not just on the very blatant level of, okay, it's getting out alternative viewpoints, and the purpose of media in a democracy is to have informed people who can make informed decisions on everything from what they buy to who they vote for, and how do we do that? It's people need to get that information, and so obviously we all know that independent media is important. But the reason I think it's really important is especially participatory media, I think that it really empowers individuals, helps them find their voice, and enables them to become a more active person and take a better role in society instead of, my personal story is that I started being involved with zines and publishing when I was 15 years old, and I was really shy, and I didn't, talk to people, and I didn't have my own opinions on things, but becoming involved in media really helped me formulate, okay, well, I have an opinion too, and it matters. And that's something that I think is often overlooked, the benefit of especially independent media. So the good things that's going on right now is that independent media doesn't lack for content, and it doesn't lack for good content. Clamor was always overwhelmed with amazing submissions. And to me, that's a sign that these outlets are needed, and they need to be supported, and people are ready and willing to take part in this conversation. I think independent media is effective. It's one way that people get turned on and educated. It's, it's like you grow up in a family and you're socialized in one way, and independent media is an effective way to reach people who are not, you know, who are beyond the choir. And so that's, those are two things that I think independent media is good, doing good. And the other thing is that independent media and new outlets have been very effective at embracing new technology and using that, incorporating that into their model. A lot of the older, you know, like a lot of newspapers are still kind of struggling with how to, you know, integrate an online community with their normal newspaper, et cetera. Okay, that was the very brief good section. Now we're going to the challenges section. Okay. I also don't want to talk forever. Some of the challenges are really broad. As the introduction mentioned, movements haven't really embraced media as being central to their work, and it is. Movements need media for many, you know, like a million different reasons. We need to communicate with each other. We need to discuss theory and strategy and help the movements advance. We need to reach people beyond the choir. We need to inform people what's going on, and kind of use it as a way to push us forward. And that's not really happening. It's, you know, labor, which was mentioned earlier. It's like, why isn't there like a big labor paper? Why isn't, you know, the new SDS embracing, like they're kind of embracing like online media, but it's like, why don't they have a newspaper or a journal or something that really kind of focuses the discussion and moves it along? Other historical movements have done that, but that's something that's really missing right now. And I think that also kind of goes into the second main problem, which is funding. And that kind of lack of embracing media and viewing it as essential means that people don't prioritize it in when they're doing their fundraising for the organization. And individuals don't prioritize it. That's a main problem with magazines, partially because listeners understand the community-supported radio model. Like, every couple of months, you know, the public radio station comes on the air and says, we need your donations. People call in, and people don't really understand that you need to support print media in the same way, because there's no real mechanism that's been established to do that kind of reader education. And I think that even some of the larger organizations, you know, like, okay, so there's labor and then movements like SDS, it's like, well, what about UFPJ? It's like they haven't really embraced media as being essential to, you know, establishing and maintaining and moving their organization forward. Many times during this conference, people have talked about the role of nonprofit organizations and foundations, and it's also true that foundations haven't supported media, particularly print media. And I really think it's important to have a community. A lot of people are like, oh, we need to just do all this education to change how grantors look and value media. It's like, well, maybe we just need to bypass the grants altogether, which a lot of people in this conversation, particularly the women from Insight, are talking about. It's like, why are we so focused on this grant model, and why don't we move instead to a community-based model? And I'm hoping that Michael will talk about the kind of how ZNet is supported. Partially, I think it's also, okay, so movements need to value media, but we as individuals need to value not only media, but just movement organizations in general. There was a time in the past, and there are still certain cultures now, that really it's very ingrained in the culture, the idea that you donate a percentage of your income to support the movement that you're involved with, or the church that you're involved with, or the community you're involved with. And we don't really have that kind of sense of obligation within some of the newer or younger social movements. It's like, if everybody who was at this conference gave 1% of their income to a movement organization or to a media organization, it's like, that would be a huge amount of money. But we don't really have that kind of sense of obligation. And I think that would be a key to bypassing the grant world and the many problems with it, is like having a community support. So because print is so resource intensive, and because it needs to be community based, I think that all print publications need to set out a goal and then continually reevaluate whether that print publication is meeting the goal and whether the community, it's working with the community to accomplish what you want to accomplish. And if it's not, you need to change the model. And so that's one of the main things. So I think that's all I'm going to talk about now. I could talk about the challenges of media forever, but we want to hear from my other two panelists.
Thank you, Jen. Just before we introduce Elizabeth, there was a study that seemed important. I mentioned this when we had our workshop in Venezuela, and that was the University of Maryland PIPA study, which actually found that 70 to 75% of people who voted for George W. Bush in the presidential election in 2004 believed firmly that Saddam Hussein was the person in league with al-Qaeda for the 9/11 attacks on the U.S., and I think about the same amount, 70 or so percent of these voters also believed that there was weapons of mass destruction that had been found in Iraq, justifying the war there. And, of course, that news came from, the study told us, came from corporate media and primarily Fox News, no surprise there. But it shows you when the debate is framed like it is in our corporate media, we have such a huge problem in overcoming the misinformation and the distortion. Right now, I'd just like to introduce to you Elizabeth DiNovella. She's the culture editor of the Progressive magazine. She writes about activism, politics, music, books, and film. She also produces Progressive Radio, a 30-minute public affairs program hosted by Matthew Rothschild. DiNovella joined the Progressive staff in 2001. She became associate editor in 2002 and culture editor in 2003. Before working for the Progressive, Elizabeth was the news and public affairs director at WORT-FM, a great community station in Madison, and she now volunteers in the news department at WORT. Thank you very much.
I bought copies of the Progressive with me, so do you mind passing them around? Because I don't want to have to lug them back to Madison. So I also want to say that I attended Z Media Institute, which Michael Albert and Lydia Sargent run, 6 years ago. And if you're interested in learning more about how to do media, I highly encourage people to go to that. And I also went to the Allied Media Conference last year that Jen organized, and it was also fantastic. So check them both out. So I currently work at the Progressive magazine, and previously I worked at WORT. I've also was somewhat involved in the creation of WIN, which is the Workers Independent News Service, which is actually daily headlines on radio stations that have a focus on labor. So I know there's been discussion of why doesn't labor have a newspaper that's national. Well, there does exist this headline news service, but it was really hard to get started. And it was really hard to get funding. And it was interesting because it seemed some of the funding comes from unions. And it seemed that some unions were more interested in paying money or using their funding for buying commercials than for creating media. But I think that hopefully is starting to change. And I believe that they're on about 60 different stations, including commercial stations, which is really great. So the Progressive is going to turn 100 years in 2009. We were started in 1909 by a Wisconsin Republican senator, actually. Bob La Follette, who was part of the Progressive era, he argued against joining World War I, and he argued against joining World War II. So we have this long history of speaking out against the war. As part of getting ready for celebrating the 100th anniversary, we are going to have a book. We're going to have a special issue. So we're going back through the old issues, which we have in our offices, and it sort of fills me with despair and hope to sort of look at the issues that we've covered, because we were talking about media monopolies in the 1940s. Universal health care was in our very first issue in 1909. So these issues have been around for a long time, but, you know, we've gotten in some places, obviously. Like, we have the right to vote, women do, but, you know, which was an issue for the magazine back when it started. I'm currently reading the issues from the 1970s. One of the things I noticed was the letter from the editor thanking the subscribers for their end-of-the-year donations. And so this idea of not having enough funding all the time has, I think, been a part of our 100-year history also. But the bulk of our money comes from our subscribers. And similar to WORT, the radio stations, the bulk of our money there also comes from our listeners. And it's a really fantastic model because it affords a level of autonomy that is very important. I'm really glad Jen went into the challenges and the positive aspects of the independent media. I just want to add one particular example of one of the reasons I think the independent media is so important is because we really broaden the public debate. When I was the news director at WORT, we did a whole week on programming around prison issues. 3 months later, Wisconsin Public Radio did a week of programming around prison issues. And I don't think that was chance. And that's when it became really clear to me how important it is to have a variety of voices on the air. One thing that I've come to realize, especially having attended the Allied Media Conference, was that we really need some funding to develop young reporters. Doing good reporting takes time and it takes money, and it would be really great if we could find a way to foster young talent. It would also be great if we had more funding for investigative reporting itself. It really does cost money, and it's really hard to pull off pieces that require a lot of either freedom of information requests or that require a lot of travel. I think one of the most important things people can do to support independent media is to subscribe to it, as Jen had said. Like, subscriptions really do keep us printing. And I mean, I subscribe to magazines I don't always get a chance to read just because I really like them and I want to make sure they're around, like Harper's. I love Harper's. I don't always have a chance to read it, but I want them to be around. And Ken Silverstein was on PBS recently about his story about posing as a lobbyist, and it was fantastic. But that sort of reporting actually takes money. And I think now that there's this move towards civic journalism, which in some ways people think it's sort of this new idea, but having come from my radio station, which has been around for 32 years, which everybody who's on the air is a volunteer, we sort of have been doing that for, you know, at least 30 years, that people don't always recognize that it takes a lot of time and money sometimes to really pull off important pieces. And I agree with what Scott was saying, that we haven't always had enough support, and I think that I was really happy to hear what Jen had said about having a community-based model, and I'm looking forward to hear what Michael has to say, because I think he's been really successful with ZNet. Because I think the internet, too, is sort of a struggle in the sense that I think people, you know, we're so used to getting stuff for free online that somehow magazines and print are going to have to figure out a way to sustain that. And I know that some independent media have been much better at it, but I think that's something that print will have to learn to deal with. So, thank you.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Our final speaker is Michael Albert, and in many ways he needs no introduction. And note that we'll try and keep the remainder of the time, an hour, maybe a little less, for discussion and some interaction so we can all throw our ideas around, do a little brainstorming, and maybe have something tangible to walk out of here with. And just a quick thought before Michael comes on, and that I was watching TV last night in a hotel here in Atlanta, and I see Michael Moore, you know, all over the news with the opening of Sicko. And there's a guy, like him or hate him, I mean, he's certainly broken through the barriers of the corporate media. And with Roger and Me Bowling for Columbine, Fahrenheit 9/11, and this latest movie Sicko, he certainly, you know, he definitely has gotten messages through to people who might not otherwise hear them. And I'm not sure, you know, you could build a model off of Michael Moore, but
1 hour with Larry King last night.
I was amazed, and I saw that, and I said, here, this is something interesting going on here. Healthcare is a big issue for everyone, whether you're a Nazi or a communist. So, Michael Albert was a co-founder of South End Press and later of Z Magazine, ZMI, as was mentioned here, and various online projects, including ZNet. He currently works as part of the Z Magazine Collective and maintains ZNet and the ZNet Sustainer Program. He also writes a column for Z, speaks publicly often, and has written over a dozen books over the years, including Thinking Forward and Thought Dreams and Looking Forward, Participatory Economics in the 21st Century, Political Economy of Participatory Economics, both with Robin Hanel. His main activist focus has been the creation and nurturance of alternative media institutions, recently mostly on the internet, and the economic model, vision, and approach called participatory economics. Michael Albert.
Just as a sidebar, does anybody know what Michael Moore was doing right before he became a film person?
Mother Jones.
Well, and does anybody know what happened at Mother Jones? He was fired. So Michael Moore, one of the most successful people in dealing with media, when he was in the alternative media community, was fired. We should look at that. I want to talk about not just the problems that we have due to others, due to the finance community, and God only knows it's a mess, and it does impose incredible problems on us, due to the feelings of the left. What should the left's response to clamor have been? Celebration. Tremendous outpouring of hope and support for a new experiment in media. That should have been the response. My guess is the response wasn't that. When the new standard was begun on the internet, to have a internet a newspaper with young people doing the reporting and a process that was participatory, what should the response have been? Well, we know what it should have been. What was it? They couldn't even get their links onto progressive and left sites, much less any place beyond that. So we have problems. Let me just start first with the mainstream media very quickly. What should be our response to the mainstream media? Well, it's not that they're not doing their job. Of course, they're doing the job perfectly. Their job is to bolster and to rationalize and to support elite structures that exist in society. So they're doing their job very well. They're not failing at it. They're succeeding at it. How should we treat them? The same way we treat General Motors or the IMF, as an institution that will only do something of value if we force them to. So why don't we have an international movement with a domestic arm in the United States, but elsewhere, and in fact with a local arm in Atlanta and other places, that is to press the press, that is a movement that seeks to win changes inside the media, seeks to support the people inside the media who have a good heart and a good mind and seeks to put pressure on the media. Instead of having a corporate globalization, anti-corporate globalization movement, not instead of it, but in addition to it, why not a movement around media which is attempting to press the press, not to convince them of the desirability of our views. We don't try to convince the owners of General Motors that they should pay higher wages because people need more money. We try to force them to pay higher wages because they won't do it for any other reason. Same thing with CNN or the New York Times. I mean, the New York Times, Christ, everybody on the left reads the New York Times religiously. First we get up and give a speech that says that the New York Times is the most venal, horrific institution on the planet. It lies, it manipulates, it treats, it bends the facts. Then we spend 2 hours a day reading it. Then we give nothing to clamor, right, or very little. This is not a very coherent and strategic approach to media. Okay, so that's one possible suggestion. Now, what about our media? Well, it's certainly true that a huge problem in alternative media is money. But I want to suggest that there's two aspects of this problem. It isn't just the world outside. So first, the world outside. The funding community doesn't fund media. Why not? In their words, and I trust me, this is true, in their words, it's not sexy. You can't brag about it at the cocktail party when you talk about where your money went. You can brag about giving money to a shelter or to, you know, something concrete, something very clear and straightforward, but you can't brag about giving money to Clamor or to the New Standard or to Z, for that matter, and so on. So it doesn't happen. Now, that's a big problem, but we're not going to change their attitudes, most likely. So the next problem that we have is our own constituency. I'll use ZNet as an example. When ZNet was online in its early years, but big, we asked for donations. We basically said, please donate. Please help us. We need media. We got roughly $100 a month in donations from the audience of people who were using ZNet. And then we decided we would make a slight change. We would change it to a sustainer program, and we would give people, for their donation, a nightly email commentary and access and use of a forum system. And we had a very good list of writers of those commentaries. And we went from $100 a month to $25,000 to $30,000 a month. But what does that mean? What literally was happening was each night I was pushing a button to send commentaries to 5,000 or 6,000 donors and not sending them to the other 290,000 users of ZNet. I could have pushed a button right next to the one that I did push and pushed and sent all those commentaries to all 300,000 people, and it wouldn't have cost any more money. Right? It would have cost almost nothing more. So in order to generate funding, we had to, what we literally were doing is withholding that content from the other 295,000 people. So each night, it was enough to make you want to go throw up. Right? But that was what one had to do in this context in order to generate the dynamic. Okay. So we have, as has been mentioned a few times, a mechanism that causes our internet activity not to be a sort of a drain on Z Magazine, but actually funding Z Magazine and everything else that we're doing. So our internet side is our main successful revenue side, I suppose you could say. But I hate to say I don't think it's replicable. I wish it was, but I doubt that it is. And the reason why is because people online feel that there's some kind of a political virtue, there's some kind of a political achievement in getting information free, that it's almost like a political act. It's a statement of activism that I get my information free. Heaven forbid I would spend any money for information because information should be free. Well, information should be free, but we don't live in the future world right now. And it doesn't take 10 seconds of analysis to realize that if everybody on the left gets their information for free, pretty soon they'll be getting their information from that which is funded by advertising or from, in essence, volunteers and hobbyists. But the progressive won't exist and various other institutions, including Z, won't exist. So one has to overcome that sentiment. It is very, very hard to overcome. Our reaction to this is that we're not sure we can. So what we're trying to do is to expand on what we have sufficiently to generate enough revenues and enough funds so that we can help not only ourselves, but really everybody else. So we're about to do a big leap on ZNet. I don't want to spend too much time talking about it, but in essence, I suppose the heart of the financial part of it is that a ZSpace, a MySpace for the left, which we think will jump our revenues and so on sufficiently to get us out of trouble and also to provide funds that we can use to help others. But I want to talk about another side of money on the left and of why did Michael get fired and what is another problem. It isn't just... Well, let's put it this way. Somebody said we should be able to get the kind of money that a church gets. A church, after all, gets 10% of people's incomes. Why can't our movements do that? Why can't our movements, from their membership, get 5%, 2%, 1%, much less 10%? We can't blame it, in this case, on our membership. We have to blame it on the movements. The movements don't deliver what the church delivers. The church delivers, it makes people more fulfilled. It gives people an identity. It gives people a feeling of involvement. It gives people daycare. It gives people courses. It gives people a place to go and meet other people and socialize. Our movements don't do that. Our movements don't provide people enough to warrant the support that we're asking for. It is not just the fault of the constituency, it's the fault of us. And I think that's also true for our media. Our media doesn't very good job. I don't want to denigrate, but if we're going to get better, then we have to look at weaknesses. And I think the weakness of our movement is, or of our media, is very similar to the weakness of our movement. So once again, why was Michael fired? Michael's too working class. Michael's demeanor and his manner and everything else, he managed to somehow get the visibility and get the stature so that now you can't ignore him. But when he didn't have that, you could fire him. Just having good ideas is not enough. And so as a result, I think that weakens our ability to reach. Somebody recently told me, somebody who is much more connected now than I am, so I have to do this secondhand, told me that the financial problem of alternative media was becoming incredibly pressing, that one publishing house after another was on the verge of disaster, that one... magazine after another was on the verge of disaster, not only because of current finances, but because of the projections into the future. The average age of the readership of the nation, Mother Jones, ITT, the progressive. I don't know that anybody knows exactly what it is, but this person felt that, from talking to people who worked at them, that it was creeping up over 60. That's average. Think about that. If you have a bunch of 20-year-olds, to get the average to 60, you either have to have a bunch of 100-year-olds or a shitload of 80-year-olds, right? We're talking average here. So once again, we can't blame that on young people. We have to blame that on ourselves, right? There's something about what we're doing that isn't appealing, that isn't communicating. Now, Z isn't so bad on that front. We have not enough numbers for the print, but they're all young. Our average age is probably 9. But it's not 9, but it's low. Another thing that I think maybe we have a little backwards. ZNet is huge. ZNet has, on a good week, about 300,000 people using it. So that's bigger than the circulation of the nation or of whatever the biggest of the progressive magazines is. That's because this is a domain in which money is less critical to build up support. In the domain of a magazine, the only way you can build up readership is by mailings that are very expensive. Online, the playing field is a little more even. Even if you don't have access to money, you can reach a larger audience. So ZNet reaches a large audience. But 300,000 people is not a lot, right? It is not a lot of people. And the idea that ZNet is the solution to CNN's lies is probably false. What ZNet could be a solution to is the development of the left, or what reaching 300,000 people matters for is our own development. There's nothing wrong with speaking to that choir. The choir of 500,000 or 1 million people who are already progressive, it's okay to talk. It's okay for us to reach each other if we're going forward. If what we're doing is talking to each other and going nowhere, that's a complete waste of time. If all we're doing is saying over and over again, the war fucking hurts, the war kills, poverty is disastrous, racism hurts, if that's all we're doing, what the hell are we doing? Does anybody who reads it not know that? Does anybody who reads... No. So unless what we're doing is generating motion, is generating new vision, new strategy, and new activity, given the constituency that we're talking to, the fact that we have the truth about the war is almost irrelevant because they all know it, right? The people who are reading the alternative media. What we need to be doing if we're going to keep talking to the left is provide something that's of merit and value to the left. If we're going to press the press, that's fine. Then we talk to CNN about putting on a labor thing or putting on a truthful thing about the war and pushing truth into the much more vast area. But if we look at our own resources are to talk to people who are already progressive, in many cases already quite left. And there, I think what we need is something else. So I think we have problems in the big institutional structures. Of course, that goes without saying. We have problems in the donor world. It's the same thing. We have problems in our own constituency's mindset, the fact that we don't support media, the fact that we think it should all be free. But we also have problems in our own, in how we view what we're doing and what we're doing. And one last thing on that, and then I'll shut up. Money doesn't just have an influence in the obvious sense. You have it, you have a bigger budget, you have more things you can do. You don't have it, you have a smaller budget. Okay, that's the part that's easy to understand. There's another part to it, though. The process of how you get it can have profound implications for what then you think it is worth doing with it and for what you are then capable of doing with it. And I don't just mean if you get it from a foundation who delivers the check with a set of instructions, it has implications. Of course, that's true. But we all know that, and we all avoid that. But there's other ways it has implications. Suppose you get it because somebody on your staff has good contacts with money people, or somebody on your staff has money. Well, that can be a problem, because 9 times out of 10 on the left, that person is the boss, right? We're against capitalism, we're against class division, but just look at our institutions and see if it isn't the case that the people who run them either are the biggest donors and working for it, or they're the people on board who have the names of the biggest donors and the access to the biggest donors hidden in their back pocket. Right? The situation is sad. I don't want to overly depress people, but I'm going to do one more thing so it's pretty clear. Each year, the ITT, the Progressive, various magazines celebrate their yearly anniversary. Every once in a while, it's 100th, but not too often. But every year, there's an anniversary. And each year, the magazines have the other magazines congratulate them and take out an ad. And this is supposed to be an act of solidarity. So ITT will take out an ad in the pages of the Progressive, or the Progressive will take out an ad in the pages of ITT, and we'll spend some money giving it to each other. And that's supposed to show a degree of solidarity. Well, in all honesty, it's a crock of shit. What's happening is a little bit of money is flowing around from place to place. What should really happen? What should really happen is that Mother Jones should have funded Clamor. That's what should really happen. Right? What really should happen is that whoever has access to more money should be funding the whole community of media. That's what really should happen. What happens instead? There's that little circulation, and then, incredibly, there's a redistribution of wealth from the small media to the large media. How can that possibly be? Well, because the nation sells its list, and the nation sells its list for a shitload of money, and so do other media groups. So the large ones sell their lists to the small ones. And in, to the extent that you have a flow of money among these media groups, it is incredibly from the smallest ones to the largest ones on a regular basis, two or three times a year, in considerable sums. This is not the way to build a media left. What it is the way to build is a competing array of media institutions, each one of which is out for itself, hides the names of its donors in its back pockets while congratulating one another, and doesn't share resources. It's a wonder that we get any place. But we do, which tells us it isn't so depressing if we did it right, if we did it with real solidarity, if we did it with real strategy, we would have an incredible effect. We do it horribly poorly, with almost no strategy, with almost no solidarity, and we still, as was described, have considerable positive effect. Right? So the good news is there's plenty to fix. Plenty to fix. That's not bad news. That's good news. The bad news is if we don't do it. Thank you.